Okay, good morning. If everybody can hear clearly, we'll start with the motivation with the prayers that we normally do. So if Steph can share the screen, that'd be great. We'll start with the praise to Shakyamuni Buddha. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being. Perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world. Supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings. To you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings. To you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme amongst humans, you were born on this earth, you paced out seven strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you, who were wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, forms supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Dust free like you, the three worlds are not. Incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Saviour having great compassion, the founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you, the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime, pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and also show the path to liberation, the holy field qualified with realizations, who are endowed, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all three ever devout homage. To all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms' atoms in all aspects, with supreme faith I pay homage. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a visual aberration, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud, see conditioned things as such. Through these merits may sentient beings attain the rank of all seeing, subdue the foe of faults, and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. And we'll recite the Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vulture's Mountain in Rajagriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of the Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra, said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: "How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom?" He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra: "Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional vectors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no visual form, no sound, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odour, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on up to and including no mind element, and no mind element or mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation and birth. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, Bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the endpoint of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as the truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared: Tayata gate gate paragate parasangate bodhisoha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated, even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharivatiputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, and those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. And we'll offer the prayer to Simhamukha, the lion-faced Dakini. I prostrate to the gathering of Dakinis in the three chakras, who abide in the holy yoga of using space. By your powers of clairvoyance and magical emanation, look after practitioners like a mother her child. Aka, Samara, Sashadara, Samaryape. Aka samara sashadara samraya pe tayata gate gate paragate parasangate bodhisoha. By the teachings of the three supreme jewels possessing the power of truth, may inner and outer hindrances be transformed, may they be dispelled, may they be pacified. Shintim kuru yesoha, may all negative forces opposed to the Dharma be completely pacified. May the host of 80,000 obstacles be pacified. May we be separated from problems and harmful conditions to Dharma. May all enjoyments be in accord with the Dharma, and may there be auspiciousness and perfect happiness here, right now. And again, we look at the foundation of all good qualities as a kind of a glance meditation on the principal points of the Lam Rim or graduated path. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. Clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect, understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once. It's greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly day and night takes its essence. This life is impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful, to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeing samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta but don't practice the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I've pacified distractions to wrong object and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all inner, outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. This ground anointed with perfect, I'm going to do the short mantra offering in Tibetan. Saji Puki Jugjin Meto Tram Ri. Anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandala Kamniyatayami. Sange Chodang Saki Chonam La Changchu Badu Dekni Kyapsushi Dage Chunyen Gi Pe Sonam Gi Drola panchia sangye drupa ju sangye chodang soki chonam la jangchu badu zakni kepsu shi dage chunyen gipe sonam gi drola panchia sangye drupa ju. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Thank you very much. And in that spirit, we'll engage in the last day of our retreat. Okay. Anything to kind of reflect on overnight anymore? We're clear about the kind of what's referred to as the object of negation, this kind of sense or feeling or assumption of a permanent, singular, partless, existing from its own side, completely independent, not dependent on anything else, self-sufficient kind of I. And knowing what that is, whether we either are experiencing it arising strongly or just there as an assumption we make about the way we are, we then sought to say, well, is this the same as the mind and body or different? And pursuing that kind of thought based upon the logic of a thing either being the same of it, same as itself or different. But also, in addition to that kind of analytical meditation on the basis of a stable shamatha, also trying to feel our way into an experience of that. And in the in-between sessions, contemplating, looking, reflecting at what experience we're having through the senses and mental consciousness, and seeing if we can glance to actually see ourselves as we really are, rather than merely assenting to existing in the way that we appear and being somewhat baffled by the illusion. If we're clear about that, maybe we can move on and look at difference. But just before we go there, are there any things remaining or anything not clear or any questions you've got around where we've got to so far?
Stuart, would you like to unmute yourself and lower your hand and ask your question?
Hi, Stuart. Hello, hello, Roy. It was just more of a comment, really. I really liked, on page 39 of the book, Paltrow Rinpoche's sacred word that His Holiness shared. And it says, can I just read it?
Please do. It's wonderful.
Much of our planning is like waiting to swim in the dry ravine. Many of our activities are like housekeeping in a dream. Delirious with fever, one does not recognize the fever. And I just think that really sums up the human condition and really what we're trying to look at here.
It does indeed. And it was, you know, His Holiness put it there for the very reason you've alighted on it. So I am pleased that it made that impression on you, and really pleased you've shared it. And Paschal Rinpoche is indeed a remarkable teacher, scholar, practitioner. There's very good biography of his life available. And in the Nyingma tradition, it's probably currently the kind of favourite go-to place for preliminary practices. It's a book of his called The Words of My Perfect Teacher by Paschal Rinpoche. Really worth a read. It's quite remarkable. And a really, really inspiring life. But yeah, that's... thanks very much for sharing that one. Anybody else? Okay. So let's find a comfortable posture. Bring our attention to the gates of the senses, what we can see, what we can hear, what we can smell, any residual tastes, and the big one, the totality of felt, somatic, physical sensations here and now in the body, in this posture. A myriad interdependent, interrelated patterns and waves of sensation. So just returning the attention there to the experience of the five senses. Just resting there, still in body, speech and mind, with the senses vividly alive. And just check out whatever we find in the sphere of mental consciousness, like a sixth sense, just expanding the scope of the attention to pick up whatever we find there. Big background emotions, positive, negative, and neutral, kind of involuntary processing, background chatter, commentary, conversations with ourselves, memories, mental images, daydreams, whatever it is, or maybe just the still empty space of the mind itself. Then radically simplify, drop down into the body. Not blocking anything else out, not suppressing anything, not trying to exclude anything, not chasing after or indulging anything. If you become identified with your experience, just recognizing that and bringing the attention back to be fully present, alert, but relaxed in the experience of the five senses and mental consciousness. Then highlighting the felt somatic sensations of the body, picking up the breath in the body, the entire rhythm of the sensations of the breath in the body, like a tidal ebb and flow within the ocean of the totality of physical sensations. Brightening the awareness, if necessary, on the in-breath, if those sensations are dull. And using the out-breath like a sigh to let go of anything we may be holding on to, physically, mentally, or emotionally. Allowing mind and body to settle into the natural state and just relaxing back into the posture and the practice. Bringing the attention back to the felt somatic sensations of the breath. Just resting there for a while. Then when you've got some attentional balance and stability, leave everything else the same, but just let go of the breath as the anchor for your attention. Just rest, single-pointed, clear, undistracted, unmoving. Open to whatever arises in the vast field of awareness, resting back into it. Single-pointed, undistracted, completely unsupported, bright, clear awareness. In that quieter space, it's kind of resting there. Let's see if we can do a little reflection into the fourth step. Consider what difference might be. You know, if we've analyzed what it might be in terms of what are the consequences that follow if the reified I is the same as mind and body? Now we're going to look at difference. And we'll look at difference here by first quoting. It's another one that is Holiness uses at this stage in the book. Just as it is known that an image of one's face is seen depending upon a mirror, but does not really exist as a face, so the conception of I exists, dependent on mind and body. But like the image of a face, the I does not at all exist as its own reality. It's another verse from Nagarjuna's precious garland of advice. I'll just read it once more for you. Just as it is known that an image of one's face is seen depending on a mirror, but does not really exist as a face, so the conception of I exists, dependent on mind and body. But like the image of a face, the I does not at all exist in its own reality. So bearing that in mind, think mental and physical things and events are often called compound phenomena because they're produced, they arise, they abide, disintegrate moment by moment. And these kind of characteristics, these mental, physical events and things, kind of reveal to us that mental and physical factors exist due to very specific causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions don't exist, they disappear or change, transform. And if the I, this reified assumption or sense of I, and the whole range of impermanent phenomena were different, if they were different from the mind and body and everything else, then the I would absurdly not have those same correct characteristics. We can look to what Chandrakirti had to say about this. He said, if the self is asserted to be different from the body and mind, then just as the consciousness is different from body, the self would be established as having a character entirely different from the mind and body. If the I and mind and body were inherently different, the I would have to be a falsely imagined phenomenon, not having the characteristics of either body or mind. That is indeed the one we think exists, if we assume that it exists in the way that it appears, but that one is a complete figment of the imagination. So when we search for the inherently existing I, you would have to come up with something separate from mind and body. And we can't, because the I is really only perceived or experienced by us in the context of mind and body, being psychophysical organisms, if you like. Again, we can look to Chandrakirti here. There is no self other than the mind-body complex, because apart from the mind-body complex, its conception does not exist. So kind of reflecting on that, we can look, feel our way in, be present to our own immediate experience, and consider some of the consequences analytically, without departing from our balance and stability in our experience of the five senses of mental consciousness right here, right now. The first consequence would be, as if they were different, the I and mind and body would have to be completely separate. Do we really experience them that way? Would it even be possible? Without a mind and a body, to have an experience of an I, to experience the appearance of it in the way that it appears. I mean, if it did exist as something completely different, and if we kind of imagine that there could be a situation where there is no body and no consciousness, it would still be possible for someone to find an I existing in and of itself, singular, permanent, partless, wholly self-sufficient, existing from its own side, completely independent of any mind or body or psychophysical complex. One might ask, what would be the difference between that and nothing at all? We know from our experience that the sense of I kind of arises in dependence on different things, and the strength of it is conditioned by that upon which it arises. It's there for a while and then disintegrates, arises again when there are certain causes and conditions. But if it was something completely different, the mind and body, it wouldn't have these characteristics at all, which is rather absurd. That sort of eye would either have just to be a figment of the imagination or somehow permanent. Kind of absurdly, that kind of eye couldn't have any physical or mental characteristics. Let's just reflect on that. You can turn those main points of reasoning over in your mind, or just feel your way into what it means. You've heard it, so present in your own experience now. Just rest, alert, single-pointed, mindful, undistracted, come back there. Keeping a gentle focus on the possibility and consequences of the sense of I being completely different from anything that might arise or be experienced by mind and body, and just rest there. Now just let go of any conceptual activity of analysis or trying to feel your way into your own experience, and just let go completely and rest in unsupported, choiceless open awareness. Just present to whatever arises moment by moment in our experience of the five senses of mental consciousness. Not trying to do anything, but return the attention back to our experience, if distracted, moment by moment. Just rest there, still in body, speech, and mind, with the senses vividly alive. And when you hear the gong struck, just let go completely. Relax, don't try to meditate or not meditate. Have a kind of another quotation here, kind of goes back. You remember in the beginning we were talking about the famous teaching of the Buddha to Bahia. You know, in the seen, there will just be the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the felt, just the felt, and in the thought, just the thought. Well, there was a really rather interesting one I found some time ago by a man called Andrew Olensky. He's a practitioner associated with the Bar Institute in America. And he said, as even a passing encounter with meditation will demonstrate, it does not take long in this mode for the reality of the external world to dissolve into irrelevance amidst a swirling sea of changing phenomena. The appearances are so apparently real, insofar as they arise and pass away with such astonishing immediacy, that the question of whether or not they are really real becomes a mere conceptual curiosity, more distracting than real. So if we really pay attention to our experience in a really alert but relaxed way, moment by moment, these qualities, you know, the three signs of being, as the Buddha called them, dukkha, suffering, anicca, impermanence, and anatta, selflessness, are in a way self-evident. But it's also good to bring the mind to bear because of its kind of habitually ingrained nature, the way we project, the way we're conditioned, and the way we habitually are, to attribute things a quality or a reality that leads us to believe that they exist in the way they appear, when in actual fact they don't. We can start to use analytical meditations like this to kind of augment that experience. I mean, going back to the fifth Dalai Lama again, if you follow on from, you know, where he's talking about the eye arising in different ways on different causes and conditions in the body and the mind, he's saying when you do the analysis, you know, if we're going to look at it from the point of view, well, if there is such a one as that, is it the same or is it different? Then if we're going to say, well, what we're trying to do here is actually come up with a concretely existing eye that actually exists in the way that it appears. And to do that, we need to, one of the ways of doing it is to say, well, is it the same or different, the mind and body? It's really kind of crucial that inquiry be alive as well as thorough. I think, you know, yesterday or the day before, I think I was talking to Tony, we were saying it's important to be creative with it, to kind of quietly engage in the analysis with some passion and enthusiasm. You know, don't let it become a dead thing. And once you've got an idea of the principles, you can come at it in many different ways from your own perspective, following those principles in a very kind of creative, engaging and passionate way. Because if we don't do that, it'll just become a bit like rote learning and repetition, and we won't feel the impact of it. Because we want to try and get to a position where we really start to question that strong sense of a self-instituting, self-existing I, and actually get to the point where we think, aha, you know, previously it seemed to me like this, you know, so true, so solid, just almost a given. But maybe it really isn't like that, you know, just to have that one doubt. And then as you kind of examine and analyze further, you become more and more convinced. You develop a conviction, which is not just something superficial, parroted words or something learned intellectually or by rote. But because of that imprint, it starts to come from the depths of your own experience. So, given these four steps in this particular way of coming at it, as I say, there are others, but this is the one His Holiness sets out in the text, how to see yourself as you really are. You need to kind of find time regularly to make sessions, and even if you don't decide to do it every day, well, maybe at least once a week, or maybe at least even once or twice a month over a long period of time. And now and again, you know, read a little around it. Also, as we're going about our ordinary everyday lives, if there's a chance to sort of be reminded, recognize and check it out, then it's worth kind of repeatedly reviewing those four steps, digging into them, enriching them, bringing your own study, observation, contemplation and meditation to it. Observing and studying when you're not meditating, you know, keep glancing and thinking about it, checking it out. As I think as Judy said also, there are many levels. You know, there are coarser and more subtle levels of this sense of an inherently existing I. So any opportunity we can take to peel it back, see it for what it is, then that's the way that we make the analysis effective. And whether that's as we're going about our business or being effective actually in the formal meditation session, we really do kind of need to pass beyond the mere words and gain a conviction that although it appears so concretely, it doesn't really exist in that way. And also to bear in mind, this is not about inculcating or accepting another belief about ourselves. The belief about ourselves that we do have this inherently existing I is already a huge problem. We want to get through the appearance, see it for what it is. And the goal here is a direct realization of the way things are, not just swapping one belief about ourselves for another, but to actually, by being present to our own experience, to realize the truth of that and have that direct realization of the way we and all things are, rather than it just becoming, you know, a learned system or another belief system. So I think His Holiness in the text itself actually says something to the effect that the realization is the imprint of extended analysis. It's a kind of a decision from within our own awareness at the, you know, at the deepest level, that this sort of inherently existing I really doesn't exist. But it is kind of a fairly deep-rooted belief. and perception about ourselves. So this, there will be over time quite a lot of resistance to letting go of it. You know, we too easily sink back into our habitual frames of reference and conceptual frameworks, understandings and experience. And sometimes it won't necessarily be a pleasant process. You know, it can at times be emotionally harrowing. But if you just get a whiff of the potential of it and come to doubt the existence of the rarefied I just once for a little bit, this prospect has the potential to be incredibly liberating and empowering at every level. It's kind of like that. I mean, having said that, it's a kind of a call or an urge to say, you know, do it seriously, but at the same time, be sensible, be open, alert, relax. And I always remember here, an Italian author called Italo Calvino. And when the millennium was turning, you know, it's 1999 to the year 2000, everybody was, media and so on, going around looking for people to say what they thought were the, you know, what are the essential things that you need for the new millennium? And lots of very good writers and intellectuals and artists and all sorts of people came up with some wonderful stuff. He just came up with one word: lightness. What do you need for the 21st century? Lightness. So yes, we want to engage, we want to bring a passion to it, we want to take it seriously, but don't forget that we very easily do take ourselves far too seriously. And believe it or not, the very misconception we're talking about is at the root of it. So just a thought there, yeah? Just a thought about that. There's a quote again from His Holiness's book, which is worth it. I can get in here quickly enough and see it. I want to go to page 175. Let's see if I can go there quickly. Not as quick as I like, but nearly there. This one, so it's on page 175 at the beginning of his page 19. It's entitled Viewing Yourself as Like an Illusion. Like a magician's illusions, dreams and a moon reflected in water, all beings and their environments are empty of inherent existence. Though not solidly existence, all these appear like bubbles coming forth in water. Gung Tang. Like a magician's illusions, dreams and a moon reflected in water, all beings and their environments are empty of inherent existence. Though not solidly existence, all these appear like bubbles coming forth in water. Echoes of the verse in the Diamond Sutra that appears in our morning prayers there. So getting this appreciation of ourselves as being illusion-like in that way. And the eyes like that. There's a rather beautiful Japanese picture of a monkey hanging off a tree, peering into a pool of water, and reflected in the pool of water is the disc of a full moon, and with his other hand he's trying to peel the moon off the surface of the water. But of course it's only an image dependent on the light coming from the moon itself and the water in which it's reflected. But of course it can't be peeled off, it can't be grasped, because it has no inherent existence, and it's been mistaken for the reality of the moon. And the monkey thinks that the moon exists there in a way that it doesn't. Again, the self is very much like the reflection of the moon in water. So as a result of kind of investigating ourselves and other phenomena, we can get to know, or at least suspect, that they appear to exist inherently, but are actually empty of any inherent existence, that they don't exist in the way that they appear to us. And that both we and all appearances are like an illusion conjured by a magician that doesn't exist quite in the way that it seems to. And examples of illusions, reflections, images, and mirages are used throughout the Buddhist tradition to provide a rough idea of the kind of conflict or tension between appearances and reality. But the realization, going back to our beginning quote, the Nagarjuna's quote of the face in the mirror, the realization that the face in the mirror is not a face doesn't yet constitute a realization of the emptiness of the mirror image itself. So even with this knowledge, we still mistake a mirror image as inherently existent. See, there's another layer there. So to view ourselves like illusions kind of requires two things. One is the false appearance of objects as inherently existent, and an understanding that we, or who, or what we're ever considering, doesn't exist in the way it appears. Although, after meditation and reflection, we and phenomena still appear to exist inherently, the power of our previous understanding kind of opens the way for us to recognize that all phenomena, including ourselves, are illusion-like in that they appear to exist in a way that they do not. There's another kind of one I remember from the Buddha in the Pali Canon that says, all things have the aspect of falsity, deceptiveness. And it's this falsity and deceptive in the sense we're gulled into thinking that they exist in a way that they don't. There are kind of many discrepancies between the way things can appear and the way they actually are. And something that's impermanent can appear impermanent. Sources of pain can appear to be sources of pleasure, you know, but in the end, they're not. I mean, we've all been there where we think, you know, this is something we really want. It's going to be really pleasurable. And maybe it is for a fleeting moment. But then eventually that which we thought to be a source of pleasure turned out to be a source of pain. I mean, it's the second level of suffering as understood by the Buddha in the First Noble Truth. It's the suffering of change. So what will eventually lead to suffering is not seen for what it really is. It's kind of mistaken as a way to happiness. And although we kind of want happiness, we don't know how to achieve it. And although we don't want pain, because we misunderstand the cause of it, this taking things to exist in the way that they don't, we end up working very hard at creating the causes for it. So in a magic show, you know, in a magician show, our senses and consciousness are deceived by the magician's tricks. And in a similar way, by going along with the appearance of inherent existence, we exaggerate the status of both good and bad phenomena And then we're led into attachment and aversion, desire, hatred, and all those actions accumulating karma and consequences that we have to subsequently experience the effects of. You know, what's not inherently existent appears to be inherently existent when we accept the appearance as a given. So seeing ourselves, people and things as existing like illusions helps to kind of reduce the negative, unfavorable emotions because they stem from our exaggeration, superimposing qualities, good or bad things, on things and ourselves way beyond any warrant or any sort of reality that they actually have. I think in His Holiness's book, he points out, not just there, but elsewhere, but it is actually in this one where he spends some time, you know, explaining how when we get angry with someone, we get a very strong sense of the wretchedness of the person we're angry with. But at some later time, however long it takes, we find our earlier perception very often laughable. You know, once we've calmed down and get a better look of that at that person as to how they actually are. So the benefit of this kind of liberating insight is that it prevents us from attributing either goodness or badness to people and objects way beyond what is actually there. It's the self-deception that something exists there that, you know, inherently exists. Inherently exists. That it's always like that. He or she is like that. I think I read a couple of days ago that, and was inclined to agree with it, but it's a very good example. It was an interview with Cher, if you remember Cher, or have heard of Cher, the singer, famous of Sonny and Cher. In her interview, being asked about Donald Trump, she said, "There's not an ounce of goodness in him, not a drop." Well, much as I could laugh, be amused and sympathize with her point of view, clearly if she's serious about that, it's based on a view of an inherently existing Donald Trump who doesn't really exist. Because his children or close friends or intimates will certainly not view him in that way. So this is the benefit of being able to have that sort of liberating insight. It kind of undermines self-deception, and the undermining of self-deception makes it possible to reduce and diminish the power of attachment and aversion, desire and hatred, since those emotions are built on these exaggerations, if you like. And the elimination of unhealthy emotions, unwholesome emotions, creates space in which healthier emotions and virtues can develop and manifest. So by viewing things with insight, as His Holiness often points out, you bring them within the scope of the practice of emptiness. A good place to rest for the moment. We can pick up again this afternoon. See, there's a... Don't forget that, as Steph reminded you at the beginning of the session, because of the way things are, there's the resource I promised earlier in terms of Douglas Harding's work. There's the full bibliography for this week, and I'll give you the full bibliography that I would have provided if we were at Land of Joy doing it for 8 or 9 days, because I, you know, it's a good one to be able to refer to. But you need to get your email into Steph, and I think you can do that by just putting it in the chat box. She can save them, I can't. Then she'll send them all to me, and I'll make a group email, BC, you know, send an email to myself, BCCing everybody else, and I'll put a few notes and attach the materials. Yeah.
Thanks, Roy. That's great. I think most people
and
have.
I see I've got a couple of one-to-one questions, so I'll use the receipt of the emails to deal with those as well. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Roy. Thank you. And Stuart's just sent a link as well, which I'll send to you with a lovely image, I think, from the moon and trying to peel off the moon.
Yeah, it is a very beautiful one. In fact, you remember at the start, and it's on the bibliography, I was talking about Jan Westerhoff's book, 12 Examples of Illusion, published by the Oxford University Press, and they've got one on there. But there he is. There's the monkey hanging off the tree, trying to reach down to peel off the image of the moon. Mm. There's another beautiful one from the Kagyu tradition, which is, you know, people seeing the moon reflected so perfectly in the water at night that they thought they'd get a fishing net and try to cast it and catch the moon in the water. But of course, it's a category mistake. It's appearing in a way that it doesn't actually exist. It sounds rather ridiculous, doesn't it? Sort of somebody going with a net to get it out. Well, whether anybody was stupid enough to do that, we don't know, but it highlights so well exactly how we try to grasp onto or get at our sense of self and inherent existence in a rather beautiful and light-hearted, but nonetheless quite serious way. So yeah, it's a wonderful image. It's beautiful. That one's on the list. Shall we do the dedication prayers?
Yeah.
And then we'll meet again this afternoon at 3. And in the meantime, continue to use your sessions as you wish, alternating between the cultivation of the shamatha, the use of the 4 steps of the analytical meditation, and just as you're going about, trying to remember, be present as much as possible, and then just glance at what's really there. Jang Chub Sem Chorin Boche Ma Kirpanam Kirgujing Kirpanyam Pa Me Payang Gong Ne Gong Lu Helwa Jo Tonyi Tawa Rinpoche Ma Kirpanam Kirgujing Kirpanyam Pa Me Payang Gong Ne Gong Ne Helwa Jo. May the precious jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise, and may that not arisen, not decline, but increase more and more. May the precious view of emptiness, not yet born, arise, may that arisen, not decline, but increase more and more. Thank you very much. Much look forward to seeing you back at 3 o'clock. And if you haven't got your email in there and want to receive the materials, don't forget to do so. Thanks very much.